It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And good morning, Vermont. It is the Dave Graham Show. Our usual intro is taking a day off, apparently. And that's okay. It is Monday, October the 7th, I believe it is, 2019. We have a good show lined up this morning. Colin Mine, my first guest, managing editor of VT Digger, frequently stops by on Monday mornings to give us the lowdown, what's been happening over the weekend and in recent days in Vermont. And I'm always glad to welcome him. He's going to be joining us in just a moment. The second part of this first hour, we'll go to Karen Kever. She is the impresaria, I think that's the word, of the Capital City Concerts in Montpelier. She's got an upcoming program going to be at the St. Augustine's Church, I believe, in Montpelier on the 19th and 20th of October. We're going to talk about some of the works that are going to be performed. It's always a beautiful thing. Karen Kever puts on magnificent performances in Montpelier, brings in some terrific musicians from around the country and internationally, and she is a terrific musician herself. And so it's a real treat for folks in our area to get to hear Capital City Concerts. We'd like to give them a little word on the Dave Graham Show every now and then. In the second hour of the program, we're going to be going to Roger Hill's going to be joining us. Of course, the WDEV meteorologist is going to be talking with us a little bit about some stuff that got said the other day about climate change. Turns out not so true. We're going to be trying to correct the record on some of that. And then a little later in the second hour, Kevin Ellis and Guy Page will be coming by and helping us get through the latest on impeachment. Excuse me one moment. Alrighty. So my first guest, Colin Mine. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Dave.
What's leading VT Digger today?
The lead story in VT Digger today is about Burlington CETO office, which is the community economic development office over there, and has sort of been at the lead of some of the more progressive economic projects. I think it started under then Mayor Bernie Sanders as a way to sort of look out for, you know, the lower income folks and sort of making sure that the city's working for everyone. And it's sort of various things have happened over the years. It's lost some of its funding. It's lost some of its sort of focus on lower income folks. So it's a story that really explores what's happened with that sort of unique part of Burlington city government and how it's fallen on rough times here.
And that was the brainchild back in the, I guess, the 1980s of a certain former mayor by the name of Bernie Sanders.
That's right.
And he obviously has gone on to other things these days, and we're going to get to some of the news about Bernie Sanders in just a couple of minutes. But is there any sense that that some of the maybe the bloom is off the rose in the way the Sanders revolution has played out in Burlington?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. You know, and I think part of it is you look at the sort of, you know, people involved. Right now you have quite a moderate Democrat leading Burlington and Murrow Weinberger, who has a background as a developer, and that sort of in some ways explains some of the changes that have happened, sort of how CETO, this community economic development office, has turned into something that really looks more after construction projects and fixing up parks and that kind of thing, rather than really bringing a sort of progressive economic vision to Burlington's development.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I could imagine that any bureaucracy that gets set up under the rubric of a city government, or really any government, is going to take on somewhat the flavor of its existing, of whatever administration is in power at the time. And so I guess I'm not all that surprised by this. Is there any thought to perhaps closing this shop and reopening something completely different, or what are we thinking about? What are they thinking about that up there?
I mean, I think certainly revising the mission is something they're going to have to do. You know, everyone sort of admits, the former head of the office, Neil Lunderville, you know, talks about how it's seen decrease federal funding. It's having trouble keeping staff there and that kind of thing. So I think certainly scaling back on their mission is something that's going to happen in the near future. And, you know, that will sort of spark a conversation beyond what this story has about, you know, what do they really want to focus on here? Is it about sort of, you know, having beautiful parks around the city? Is it about sort of making sure that, you know, people have access to basic services? Is it a housing type of thing? You know, what exactly is it that they want this office to focus on that's most important to economic development of Burlington?
Could go in a wide variety of directions, of course, and I do suspect that some of its flavor is going to depend on whoever the mayor is and whoever is leading the office. Of course, Neil Lunderville, longtime Republican activist in Vermont, never really considered, to my knowledge, in league with the progressives who started this CETO office back in the 1980s again. And so this doesn't surprise me that the place has taken on a different flavor and maybe looking for a new, certainly a new style, if not a completely new mission.
And it is worth noting that Burlington, you know, big picture politics has certainly taken on. The progressives had quite a successful election last year, and, you know, that's shown through. And we had another story about that we may talk about today, about some of the city councilors considering legal action against Brookfield, comes to arming police and, you know, across the board sort of issues that are important to folks in Burlington. There's a much louder progressive voice these past few months than there has been previously. So if you're going to have a conversation about what economic development looks like, certainly it will have a more sort of Bernie Sanders-ish perspective now than it would have a couple years ago when sort of more moderate Democrats were really leading the political conversation over there.
Yeah, good point. So, I mean, actually, with the progressives resurgent in Burlington right now, I mean, maybe this is kind of the ripple of what political conditions were like in the city a couple of years ago that CETO is feeling right now. And perhaps if there were any big move to change it or shut it down and replace it with something else, then you'd see a lot of progressive energy devoted to trying to preserve it, possibly.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, sort of revert back to something a bit more like the original mission, which really was focusing on the more vulnerable folks in the city and not so much about sort of physical development.
Interesting stuff. Burlington's always a fascinating political entity. Kind of unto itself here in Vermont. Obviously, it has a huge influence statewide, but it also is it's its own special case in many, many instances. So, hey, let's look at for a moment at the latest on the EB5, the EB5 sort of development scandal. I guess it has been this long-running saga in the northern part of the state. Big court decision the other day.
Yeah, I think this is one of the more significant developments in quite some time in the case. I mean, you know, if you read vtdigger.org regularly, we're constantly covering the sort of latest twists and turns in the EB5 saga. But this Supreme Court decision really opens the way for scrutiny of state involvement in this scandal in a way that hasn't really been possible previously. I mean, my boss, Ann Galloway, has been sort of trying to get at state involvement in this whole scheme and sort of what they knew about. You know, it's pretty well established at this point, although no one's been, you know, admitted to any guilt, but that Ariel Quiros and Bill Stanger, who were the businessmen leading this project, you know, they've been accused of pretty serious fraud allegations and settled with the SEC for quite a bit of money. A lawyer who's been representing investors in this case named Russell Barr has been trying to sort of talk about how and trying to actually question and subpoena state officials who may have known what was going on when all of this sort of fraud was taking place. And having a really hard time doing that. At the superior courts, he's been blocked in every way imaginable. And one of the cases got to the Supreme Court, and they've decided now that the trial should be able to move forward, and he'll be able to question and depose some state officials who were involved in the EB5 regional center at the time when the fraud was sort of peaking.
The EB5 matter here, I do think that court decision on Friday really does open up a door that could result in a lot of scrutiny on state government, it seemed. The real question was, can the state actually be sued on this stuff? I mean, or you tell me, you're closer to this than I am, but do I have that right that's the real question and the answer from the Supreme Court essentially is yes?
Yeah, so generally, state officials have sort of legal privileges that prevent them from being held personally responsible for this sort of thing. But there's a particular tariff act in Vermont that seems specifically catered to the community, the Agency of Commerce and Community Development, and projects that they're involved in where people invest specifically because they've made commitments to oversee it, and that sort of thing that sort of allows them to face legal action in a way that most state officials can't. And that's really the sort of linchpin of this Supreme Court decision, is this very particular act that exposes the Agency of Community Development to this sort of lawsuit. And indeed, the ACCD was the main agency overseeing the EB-5 program. So officials who are involved in the James Candido, for example, who was the head of the EB-5 Center at the time, will likely have to be deposed, as well as people who are leading the Agency of Commerce and Community of Development at the time.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more to come on this, and it actually could get a lot thicker now, because there's going to be, one would think, an increased information flow from these people now that they are actually potentially in the dock here. So, you know, we'll have to be, I'm sure VT Digger will be watching this thing closely. It's been the news leader on this topic and many others, but this one in particular really has broken most of the important stories on the EB-5 scandals over the years that it's been in play. I'm just saying, keep at it, guys. It is an important story. Some of it can be a little dry sometimes, but I think it's really you got to make sure that when government gets into these relationships where there's all this talk of public-private partnership and how much is the government a player and how much is the government a regulator, I think are important issues that need to be sorted out. It looks like they were not sufficiently sorted out from the beginning of this thing, and they may still yet be in a courtroom someplace. So yeah. You'll be keeping an eye on that, I'm sure. So another legal tangle is the subject of net neutrality. The recent court decision on this as well, and Vermont looking to go its own way a little bit as compared to what the federal government wants to do. Fill us in on the details here, Colin Mine.
Yeah, so about a year and a half ago, the Senate and House passed a bill, and the governor signed an executive order here in Vermont that sort of, as the Trump administration was trying to repeal some of the Obama-era net neutrality rules, Vermont tried to put some back in place, basically. And the rules in Vermont would have – Vermont's not actually allowed to regulate. States aren't allowed to regulate internet providers. That's the federal government's mandate. But sort of as an end around to that, they said the companies that want to do contracting with the state, which is most of the big telecom internet providers here in Vermont, would have to follow these Obama-era net neutrality standards, which, you know, prevent companies from throttling internet speeds up and down depending on how much people are paying, or prevents internet companies from providing higher speed internet to, say, websites that they're affiliated with, or to services that are paying them sort of extra to give them higher internet speed. The idea is that you sort of have equity and fairness in internet provisions. So that law was passed. Governor Scott signed an executive order doing the same thing. And Comcast and its industry friends quickly brought a lawsuit against Vermont, saying that it did not have the authority to do that and that it couldn't use this sort of state contracting power to regulate industries that it's not otherwise allowed to regulate. That was put on hold, sort of pending a federal decision in a separate case, which was sort of a broader lawsuit against the Federal Communications Commission, chaired by, what's his name, Ajit Pai or something like that?
Ajit Pai, yep.
Yeah. And they've sort of been leading this federal rollback. So there was an agreement to sort of put the Vermont litigation on hold and not enforce those laws pending this FCC decision. And an initial decision has been made in the FCC case, which found that the regulations, the rollback largely was okay, that sort of rolling back the federal standards from the Obama administration was allowable, but also indicated that states would be able to regulate their own sort of net neutrality rules as they please.
Yeah, that's actually interesting. And did the court kick it back to the lower? Did the court kick it back to the FCC and say, figure out what the state's role is here? Is that still in play?
Yeah, I mean, so this is where we're at right now, is that the sort of actual impact of this decision on the FCC rules and whether the FCC wants to change its sort of orders is up in the air, as well as the appeals process and whether or not the FCC will appeal the decision, or, you know, whether sort of some of the groups who brought the how both sides are going to sort of react to this decision is still up in the air. And therefore, Vermont's attorney general's office has basically said, we're not going to change anything in how we're doing things right now. The sort of state net neutrality rules are going to remain on pause until this sort of federal process plays out to the end. And then we sort of know what it is exactly we're dealing with and how we want to move forward on it.
So it's really not clear yet as to whether Vermont will get the even play in its own small ball field here. That's still up in the air. Is that a good way to look at it? Or
yeah, I mean, I think the decision is, everyone sort of agrees it's a good thing for states as far as their ability to do this sort of regulation on net neutrality. Mm-hmm. I think the question is sort of what exactly will be the federal law or federal decision that they're dealing with, and how can they sort of move forward as a state and, you know, hopefully avoid this sort of costly litigation that groups like Comcast are bringing against them. And, you know, if the federal decision provides sort of a crystal clear path forward for states to regulate, then you imagine that Vermont would be willing to sort of adapt the law and executive order that it briefly put into force a year and a half ago in order to sort of fit within that.
It's really interesting to me. This has a slight echoes of like the big Entergy case in the Vermont Yankee, where Vermont has this habit of trying to, I don't know, stick its finger in the eye of the federal government occasionally and say, "Hey, we're going to go our own way on stuff, and we think we have a better way here." And then, you know, the federal government and the federal courts, the large corporations that deal in many states, if not internationally, are coming in basically saying, you know, I think they would love to see this net get stomped on once again. That seems to be the general theme of this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and in the state house, you sort of have lawmakers. You know, there's this right to repair issue happening right now, where every industry in the world doesn't want this to happen. You know, it basically allows consumers to repair their own electronics and this kind of thing. And Vermont's sort of trying to lead the way with loads of lawsuits sort of down the road if they do and pass any law, as with this net neutrality law, which I think that they could have seen lawsuits coming up. And the lawmakers say, you know, sort of big corporations be damned, we're going to do the right thing. You know, we're not going to be scared of them. But then you get there and, you know, the attorney general office is, you know, has limited resources going against some of the biggest corporations in the world. And that's not an ideal scenario as well. So
GMO labeling, another famous case of this, where Vermont is basically telling, you know, these giant corporations and the federal government that, you know, we have a better way of doing things up here. And the response is often, well, nice idea, but you're not going to do that. So that's the way, and we'll see how this plays out. But I just have a feeling that we're going to be in that kind of end up in that kind of a battle again.
And it could be the case that the whatever plays out here on the federal level actually opens the way for a more significant net neutrality law in Vermont. They came up with something that's sort of, you know, quite limited in scope, and that it only applies to companies that want to do business with the state, which, mm-hmm. You know, in a rather small state is actually most of the companies, perhaps all of them. But at the same time, you know, it's possible that this federal decision would allow states to, you know, cast a broader net in that and just have their own net neutrality rules, you know, across the board.
Boy, that would be probably even a bigger fight, but we'll see. We'll have to watch and see how that plays out. Let's turn our attention back to the Queen City for a moment, because there is talk about a large corporation and dealing with Vermont elected officials. What's this out? It's called Brookfield, I believe. Is the
Brookfield
investment.
Asset Management.
Yeah, it's the company that owns this property in Burlington that was, they were promising they were going to build something new and big and shiny there, and right now they got a hole.
Yeah. So this is one of the, you know, as you said, one of the biggest sort of hedge funds in the world, going up against, you know, Burlington City Council. And, you know, city councilors are extremely frustrated that this hole in the middle of Burlington still exists, where, you know, there's supposed to be a multi-use, I think 14-story building was the plan at one point, a mall, living space, office space. And the sort of face of the project, Don Sinex, for quite some time has sort of stepped aside, and into his place has stepped the rather faceless Brookfield Asset Management, which occasionally sort of sends very bland and non-committal updates on what they're doing, and leaving everyone sort of wondering what the heck is happening and when can we actually expect some foundation to go in here and a building to start to go up. Brookfield has said that they're redesigning the project at the moment. They haven't provided any sort of indication of what that redesign might be or when they're going to give a sort of final design that can once again sort of start to move through the approval process. So in the meantime, city councilors are just sort of, you know, wringing their hands about what do we do here? How do we get them moving? And, you know, they've gotten to the point now where they're talking about whether legal action is something that might actually get the ball rolling here. I think that, you know, all the city councilors in this story by Aidan Quigley on VT Digger talk about how actually pursuing, you know, actually filing a lawsuit probably is not the way to get this project moving. But I think the hope is that by talking about it, maybe they'll show Brookfield that they're serious and get some kind of movement here.
You know, again, this David and Goliath theme where we seem to be hitting on it a lot this morning, but the Burlington City Council versus this Wall Street behemoth, I mean, in a lot of ways, I think a lot of Vermonters sort of appreciate the, you know, the pluck and the sort of feistiness of our little state here. But I also think that some of these projects of trying to create a bigger ripple than Vermont might ordinarily cause by virtue of its population or its financial clout, even, you have to kind of look at it sometimes and say, wow, we're fighting above our weight. Let's put it that way. So,
yeah. And I think the issue for Burlington here is that, you know, there's no obvious choice apart from Brookfield. You know, they've sort of gotten, you know, if you've been over there, they've cleared this area. There's, you know, sort of this big open space and, you know, sort of prime area in Burlington. And if they, you know, if it gets so acrimonious with Brookfield that, you know, they part ways or this goes to litigation, which would, you know, be a years long process, then there's not really, you know, any sort of clear way forward on that. There's not, this experience makes people only less likely to invest the millions and millions of dollars needed to put up the sort of building that's being talked about here. So, you know, if they can't figure this out with Brookfield, then that space could remain open for years and years and years.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. Hey, let's turn our attention to our junior senator from the state of Vermont, presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. He had a health scare last week and is back home, I guess, in Burlington. And what's the latest we're hearing about Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, so the big news at the end of the last week was that he did, in fact, have a heart attack, which was not clear. The campaign sort of talked around it. It's not clear when they sort of understood that, you know, that it's a, what is it called, the myocardial infarction.
Yep.
And that's actually what happened there. So as he left the hospital in Las Vegas where he was treated, doctors and the campaign, you know, said that he had in fact had a heart attack, which is pretty significant. And he headed back to Burlington where he is now. He's going to sort of rest up for a few days here. It's unclear, you know, it could be a few days, could be a couple weeks. The campaign says that he's hoping to be back in action for the debate in the middle of the month. So obviously lots of people watching that. You know, the lead sort of New York Times, you know, coming out of the Democratic campaign, Bernie Sanders, you know, was the lead national story for a few days for all the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether or not he's able to sort of pick back up where he left off for, I mean, certainly there's been lots of analysis on VT Digger and elsewhere about how for a 78-year-old candidate, a heart attack is not a good look in the middle of a campaign. And whether or not he can sort of get back any of his mojo here is questionable, no doubt.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I guess we'll have to wait and see what he does. I mean, he's going to have to think about, can I really stay with this? And obviously, no one knows an individual's health like the individual going through this stuff. And so, you know, and again, I think we're all rooting for continued good health for years to come for Bernie Sanders. But obviously, nobody lasts forever, and he is 78 years old, and that is a concern for. And it was very. Put into stark relief last week, and so we'll just have to wait for further word from Bernie Sanders. Sometimes I think, if I understand how these things work, I've had family members go through this kind of stuff. You can actually get into a situation where you don't know immediately. You got to get some follow-up tests and stuff to determine whether, in fact, it was a heart attack or just an arterial blockage or what. So maybe it's not so much the campaign being reticent as much as just awaiting the test results. But anyway, we'll keep following all of these stories with the help of Colin Mind and vtdigger.org. Colin is the managing editor. There has been my guest this morning. Thanks very much for coming in, Colin.
Thanks so much, Dave.
All righty, we're going to be back. Have a conversation with Karen Kever, the Capital City Concerts, after the break at the bottom of the hour. Stay with us, folks.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And we are back for the second half hour of our program on this Monday morning, October the 7th, 2019. Thanks for staying with us, folks. One of the real highlights, I think, of living around Montpelier in this part of Vermont is that we have some great musical offerings going on here, and they're all really accessible. Ticket prices tend to be quite reasonable. Folks can get out and hear a wide variety of excellent music, everything from rock and jazz to classical music. My wife and I went up to the Highland Arts Center Highland Center for the Arts in Greensboro yesterday and heard the Vermont Symphony Orchestra. Terrific performance there. They had this a young cellist to 16 years old and just knocked the socks off of everybody playing a Haydn cello concerto, and it was really a wonderful thing. And I think a lot of Vermonters are just kind of pinch themselves and say, how is it that we get such terrific music around these parts? And one of the big reasons we get terrific music around these parts is that we have Karen Kever living in our midst here in Vermont. She is impresaria of the Capital City Concerts, a world-class flutist herself, and brings in a lot of other terrific musicians, and she's going to do some of that later this month. I think Karen's on the phone with us this morning to tell us all about it. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning, Dave.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
No major complaints. I just wanted to check in with you about Sleepers Awake. This is actually a good theme for me this morning because I was just telling my previous guest, Colin Mine, on the break that woke up at about 3 this morning and there was the rain was hitting the metal roof of our porch so hard I couldn't get back to sleep. So if you need to nudge me over the phone here a couple times, bear with me. But anyway, I want to ask you about this program upcoming. It's going to be at the 19th and 20th at the St. Augustine's Church in Montpelier.
Yeah, it'll be in Montpelier on Saturday, October 19th at St. Augustine Church. And then Sunday afternoon, October 20th at 3 p.m., we'll be at St. Paul's Cathedral in Burlington.
Right. Up in Burlington.
Yes.
Yeah. And two opportunities to hear some terrific music here. Tell us a little bit about this. This is Sleepers Awake is one of Bach's most beloved cantatas, I see. Tell us a little about it.
Sure. Well, last year, I'm sure you remember, and a lot of folks remember, we put on a couple performances of Bach's Magnificat, and it was incredibly well received and attended. Mm-hmm. And a huge number of people involved and a huge amount of work. And I said, I'll never do something like that again. And here we are doing something like that again.
Yep.
So this is another big production with an orchestra and chorus and three really stellar soloists who are really our world-class Bach specialist singers who will be on for this. Dick Riley is going to be conducting again. And yeah, this is one of Bach's, I would say, most beloved and well-known cantatas. And a cantata, kind of an interesting word. It comes from the Italian to sing. And what it is it's a piece that's about a half hour long in a number of sections, and it includes moments where the spotlight is on the chorus, and there are arias that feature our wonderful singers, and they're accompanied by a colorful orchestra. And this particular cantata, I think, is timely in a lot of ways. Sleepers Awake. I think we can all relate to that in a variety of ways right now in the world that we're living in, this sense that we need to kind of wake up. The piece was written by Bach in a hurry. It was his job to write these cantatas, which happened weekly. He did this for a period of about 18 years, pretty much every week. And so this is one of them. He wrote it in 1731, and it's based on the parable of the 10 wise and foolish virgins who are processing to a wedding feast. That's kind of a dark parable, and I think he knew that. And so he departed from that a bit and incorporated passages from, beautiful passages from the Song of Psalms. So in this piece, we have love duets. There's the gorgeous Night Watchman song, which if anybody wanted to Google that, they could probably just Google Bach Night Watchman song, and what will come up is one of the most familiar and beloved pieces that Bach ever wrote. And it's also interesting, too, he wrote this piece, and it's based on a hymn that was written long before Bach was alive. It was written by a pastor in a small town in Germany that was devastated by a plague, and about 1,300 people in this town died. And he thought, this pastor thought, he was going to be among them. He came very close to death, but he survived. And when he recovered, he wrote this beautiful chorale hymn. And you often hear at the end of a cantata, you hear a chorale type of hymn, and you get that here, but he also weaves it into the rest of the cantata, the opening, which is so stirring. It gives me chills just to think of it talking to you right now. It's the procession of the virgins, and underlying that is the chorale theme. And then later on in the most famous Watchman song, the chorale is also underlaid there. And it's very beautiful. There's something theatrical about the layout of the music. Whenever I hear it, I sort of flash on seeing a play by Shakespeare. It's got that kind of quality of theater, and it's incredibly touching, and I think something that our souls could use a good dose of right now, some big Bach. So that's the main piece on the program, but we'll also be featuring our singers. Each one will have a solo aria that they will do, and we're really happy to be welcoming back violinist Lori Smuckler, who has really become a regular on the series, and she'll be featured in the Violin Concerto in A Minor, which is another one that's very well known and beloved.
That's going to be a terrific program. The singers, help me with the pronunciation here. Is it Hayuna Yu? Is it soprano?
That's pretty cool. He always tells me, think of it as the Korean way to say the name Hannah. It's Hyuna Yu.
Hyuna Yu.
She was the first singer we ever hired to do a Bach program, and our Bach programs now go back about 18 years, and she's the only soprano I've ever hired. She's not one of these run-for-the-exit sopranos. She has the most crystalline angelic voice. It, you know, you hear her sing and you don't want her to stop. It's incredibly beautiful. And then we also have a baritone coming. Nathaniel Sullivan is coming to New York City. This is his first time. And he, as well as our tenor, who is coming, Stephen Paul Spears, are colleagues of Hina, and that's actually how we came to hire them. She said, I'd really love to work with these guys. So they are three people who work together often, and I know it will come together beautifully.
Is she based in New York, too?
No, she's based in the Baltimore area.
Oh, I see. Okay. Huh. And she obviously is traveling around quite a bit internationally and in the United States and performing various concerts. I have heard her numerous times before at your concerts, and I always kind of pinch myself and say, we're such a small venue up here. How do we get somebody this good?
You know, well, I think it's friendship, really.
What it is. We've been friends for a long time and have worked together a long time,
and she has never said no to an invitation to come and sing Bach.
That's tremendous. And I mean, you do have an amazing Rolodex, or not a Rolodex, I'm dating myself here, contact directory, I guess it would be, of performers you call on from away who come in and fill out the various musical roles of whatever performance you're putting on. And I mean, it really is something that I'm just telling our listeners here that if you haven't been able to catch a performance of Capital City Concerts yet, put it on your schedule. It is something that is just a real treat. It's beautiful, beautiful. These are beautiful performances, and they actually are of really, you know, big city quality, and they're right here in these little places. Well, Burlington is a big city by Vermont standards, but Montpelier, it always just makes me a little bit awestruck to think that our little town gets such high quality performances, and I really commend you and thank you for that, Karen. It's been a great run for you guys.
That's very generous of you. You should be sleep deprived more often. You're very sweet.
Well, you have a couple of other concerts upcoming this season as well. Do you have anything you can tell us about yet?
Sure. Yeah, in January, Jeffrey Chappell is coming back from Washington D.C. He's a pianist who's been a part of the series from the very first year, and that's going to be a really special program. We're doing it twice. The weekend, I should have this memorized, the weekend of January 18th and 19th, we're actually doing two duplicate performances at the Unitarian Church, and he'll be performing pictures at an exhibition, and as part of that, we have area students who are going to be creating original artwork based on the 10 descriptive movements from that piece. It's really colorful and wonderful, and similarly, we'll be performing some music that will be played while projected images of photographs from James Blair, who is an extraordinary retired National Geographic photographer who lives in Middlebury. His images will be projected above the stage during that performance. So that'll be wonderful.
Yeah, and sort of a multimedia approach, something new.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Really big deal, and I keep telling people, don't wait to get your tickets. We have the return of the Paris Piano Trio, which is a group that's played many times on Capital City Concerts, but not for a while. They're all getting somewhat older, but they still perform together in Europe, and they are coming here for what is probably going to be their last U.S. performance, and they are doing just one concert for us because this is our 20th birthday season. And that's happening on Sunday, March 8th. So you can go right now and get tickets at our website. I wouldn't wait. They are selling. And when it's sold out, it's sold out. And these guys are not to be missed. They are absolutely world class.
That will be at the Unitarian Church as well?
It will, yeah. So it's a pretty small venue.
Yeah, yeah. Karen, I was just going to ask you, what is your official title with Capital City Concerts, so I can introduce you properly from now on? Are you impresaria or executive director or music director?
I think I'm the head monkey, I think is the term.
Grand Pooba, I don't know.
I've always been referred to as the artistic director, so that works.
Yeah, okay, artistic director. There we go. I wanted to ask you about the venues. It's interesting to me most of your concerts, I think, tell me if I'm wrong about this, at least the ones in Montpelier, have been at the Unitarian Church. You have busted out a couple times now for at least the second time over to St. Augustine's, a bigger auditorium or sanctuary or whatever you want to call it, right?
Yes. Do you
know how many seats roughly in each one of these two halls?
Well, the Unitarian Church only holds 230, and last year we were told that the Catholic Church held 750, and we filled it.
Yeah.
I'm not actually sure it really holds that many, and in fact, funny you should mention it, because I'm heading over there this afternoon to do some math. We want to be sure that we have seats for everyone who would like to come, and that none of them be obstructed view seats, because there are large pillars. So we're going to be limiting the audience number somewhat from what we did last year, so everyone gets a good seat.
I see. Okay. Yeah, I know in the church there they do have the big pillars holding up. It's probably the closest thing Montpelier has to a cathedral. I guess it doesn't really qualify as a cathedral, but it's a big church. And an interesting piece of architecture itself there on Barry Street. How do you like them? Yeah. Compare them acoustically for a moment. Which do you prefer that way?
Oh, I love the Unitarian Church. I feel like that's home. But there's just no way we could do something, a production this big, in such a small space. Not only from the audience perspective, but from the musician's perspective, when you have an orchestra and a chorus and soloists, there's just not enough room at the Unitarian Church to do it. So there's plenty of room to set up at St. Augustine. So that's why we're there.
Yeah, and it is. I remember I went to the performance last year, and even there, you definitely filled the altar. It seemed to be a good space for you, and there wasn't a lot of extra room, but it seemed that you were able to fill it up and fill it up with sound, and that was quite quite something. So it's sheer pleasure there in the tiny little capital city of Montpelier. Now, Karen, you lived in Montpelier for a number of years. A few years ago, I guess, moved over to Addison County. Is that right?
I did, but I'll tell you, my heart still lies in Montpelier. I think always think of Montpelier as home, but I met a guy, and we got married. He teaches at Middlebury College, and he's the guy with the real job. So if somebody was going to have to move, it was me. And we make compromises in our lives, and there's a lot that I love about being in the Champlain Valley, and of course about being with my wonderful husband. But I guess now I feel like I have two homes.
Yeah,
but I lived in Montpelier for a long time, raised my son there, and he went through the whole school system with your son James.
That's true.
So Montpelier is so special to me, and I always feel like every time I arrive there, I'm back home again.
Yeah, are you putting on concerts very often in the Middlebury area, or I know you do up in Burlington some, but. Are you getting a presence over there?
Yeah, not nearly as often as the Montpelier area, but somewhat. In fact, we did a concert. I did a concert with pianist Diana Fanning and cellist Juka Davidoff back in August. The beautiful Performing Arts Center of Middlebury College, which was kind of a smaller version of the concert I mentioned before, the Pictures at an Exhibition concert. And we performed the piece I mentioned with the projections of the images by National Geographic photographer James Blair. That was in early August, and we packed the place. So that was wonderful. I do love playing in the in the hall there at Middlebury College. It's a great place with an amazing piano.
I haven't actually had the pleasure of taking in a musical event there. Maybe we'll have to travel over that way at some point and do that.
Worth it.
That sounds like quite something. And the so you're sort of, I don't know, bi-coastal now, I guess. Mm-hmm. Between Montpelier and Addison County, but the certainly Montpelier is still I think guarding you jealously. So
well, that's fine. There was a review I think that Jim Lowe from the Times Argus did last year, and he referred to me as Montpelier / Cornwall flutist Karen Kevra, and I love that because that's actually right. I think it will always be that way.
Have flute, will travel, or something like that. So
well, there's that, yeah.
But the I guess your own story is something that is not all that uncommon in Vermont. People do move around and travel quite a bit, and have to, as you put it, make compromises about where they're going to live and where they're going to work and all that stuff. So it's a few more miles on the car, I gather, but that's just the way it goes around here. So.
It is. It's fine. I drive a little Fiat 500, and I'm averaging about 42 miles per gallon over the life of the car. So
wow, that's pretty good.
Doing pretty well.
Yeah, that's not bad at all. Well, Karen Kevra, I wish you continued safe travels around Vermont and many, many more concerts to come. This is going to be a brilliant performance on the 19th and 20th. The 19th at St. Augustine's Church in Montpelier, the 20th it's an afternoon performance, a matinee.
Yeah, 3:00.
At the St. Paul's Cathedral in Burlington, correct?
That's right, and there's all kinds of information at our website. Tickets can be ordered there. Mm-hmm. Tickets can also be purchased in person with a check or cash at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier. But for folks who are interested in checking out our website and learning more about the programs and the musicians, they can go to capitalcityconcerts.org.
It's a great website. I was looking at it this morning, and there's a lot of great information there. So I do recommend it. Hey, Karen, got to go to a top of the hour break here. I thank you very much for joining me this morning. It's always great talking with you. And I don't know, do you say break a leg to musicians? I know you do to actors and so on. But
don't say it to me because I have a habit of doing that.
All right. I won't say it then.
Well, you can use the French alternative.
The French alternative. How's that go?
You can Google it. It's not something I think the the FCC will allow.
All right. Well,
but thank you.
Got it. Hey, thanks, Karen. We'll talk soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
All righty. Hey, we're going to go to a little CBS News at top of the hour and some words from our sponsors. Back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. Stay with us, folks.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we continue into our second hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM on this rainy Monday morning, the 7th of October, 2019. Wanted to bring in a special guest appearance, a quick guest appearance by Roger Hill, WDEV's meteorologist, and because something a subject came up the other day on the Dave Graham Show, one of the things I like to do, I don't always like to do it, but I feel a need to do it on the Dave Graham Show, is to correct any misimpressions that might be floating around out there as a result of something got said the other day on one of my programs. And for instance, last week at some point, I think I made a mistake myself, and I said that the you can live stream Red Sox games on WDEV's website. That turns out, I'm told, not to be the case. And WEEI in Boston, where these where the ball games originate, apparently has something to say about that. Maybe you have to go to their website. I'm not sure which, but you can always get it on the live airwaves here from WDEV, right up here in good old Vermont and nearby parts of New York and New Hampshire on our airwaves. So anyway, that's corrected. I'll check that off the list here. The other thing I wanted to get back to was a discussion we had with a caller by the name of Ziggy from Newport on Friday. And Ziggy was saying that there was a story out somewhere he had seen indicating that NASA was out with some new statements about climate change, indicating for perhaps that climate change was not as much human caused as by certain natural phenomena. And I started checking around on this, and I could not find any recent reporting with the keywords NASA and climate change. I was scratching around all over, and finally I came across something from my old employer. The Associated Press does a weekly feature they call Not Real News, which I guess is that probably means sort of fake news, folks. But what the AP does these days is they come up with a list of stories that are floating around on the internet once a week. And they essentially, when the stories are not true, they say, here's the real facts, folks. They do a little fact check on some of these more popular internet stories out there that are not true. And for instance, last week, their second item on their list involved a report that the Church of Sweden had identified Greta Thunberg, the climate activist from that country, young woman. I think she's 16 or 17 years old, and she supposedly had been named by the Church of Sweden as a quote-unquote successor to Jesus Christ. And the AP did a nice job of calling up the Church of Sweden and saying, what gives here? And the Church of Sweden said, well, we like Greta and everything, but she's not a successor to Jesus Christ. So we're gonna debunk that one right off the bat. And that was the AP's second lead item. However, last week, the first item on their list of debunkable stories that have been floating around the internet was apparently the story that our friend Ziggy from Newport saw on Friday and or had seen. He mentioned it on Friday, and he had seen this thing. And this is saying articles containing circulating online in early October wrongly suggest that NASA has rejected human responsibility for climate change and instead attributed the phenomenon to variations in the Earth's axis and tilt. And they quote a Kate Marvel, research scientist for NASA, as saying, oh, for heaven's sake. That was in an email, so I don't know what she might have said on the phone or anything, but oh, for heaven's sake was her opening comment, apparently, in this email. Climate change is a function of largely, at least the climate change that has occurred in the last 150 years, largely a function of human emissions. And so that's what NASA has been saying for years now and apparently continues to say, despite what certain listeners to the Dave Graham Show might have seen on the floating around on the internet out there. Roger Hill, you are somebody who has studied climate change since the 1980s, I understand.
Yep.
You must have seen a lot of this stuff over the years.
It seems like the flow of sort of misinformation kind of it blows up and then it kind of stalls and ebbs and then it blows up again. And a lot of the stuff that you see that, you know, being in the field and studying these things and knowing, you know, have a pretty good handle on it, I consider myself informed because I'm not a researcher, but I use the climate science that the researchers have presented. And based on everything that I'm seeing, there's no such change by NASA or NOAA or anybody else that might be considered experts on this.
Yeah, I mean, that is something important to know, people. You don't have to necessarily just believe everything you read on the internet. In fact, one caution I would urge folks to remember is that sometimes you have a certain political or ideological point of view yourself, and you see something on the internet that you would like to be true. You sort of wish it were true. And so because it's there on the internet, you might have a tendency to go ahead and think it's true. Well, check it out, especially if it goes against If it's something that seems to be out of line with a lot of what the other reporting has been for a number of years now, there is an awful lot of reporting out there from a wide range of highly skilled scientific groups. In fact, NASA, I saw a few months ago, I looked at one of the NASA websites on climate change, and they list a group of scientific organizations out there that are saying climate change is a significant problem in the Earth's environment, and it is caused by human beings. And this is everybody from, you know, the American Society of for the Advancement of Science to the American Medical Association to all sorts of scientifically oriented groups out there have come to the same conclusion, which is that climate change is a real problem and it is being caused by human beings. So if you suddenly see a story on the internet, if you sort of wish you could be skeptical about that and go ahead and drive the gas guzzler or whatever and not worry about it, and you wish you could be skeptical, and then you see one story on the internet saying, here's a reason to be skeptical, I would be skeptical of that story. Would you, Roger?
I would. If anything, I think it's underplayed a little bit. Now, that might be my bias, but the bias that I see is the IPCC, the Interpanel Government Panel on Climate Change, is underestimating sea level rise, for example, consistently, and have been through the last decade or so. Now they're trying to catch up, so they're presenting, you know, more information on that to kind of get a good grasp on that. But that's, sea level rise is going to be a huge phenomenon, and just as it is with the thickness of the ocean expanding due to the heating of the ocean, which is where more of the carbon dioxide heating goes into right now than the atmosphere.
Yeah. Hey, we got a couple callers on the line. Let's go to Ernest in Plainfield. Good morning, Ernest.
Good morning. I don't know the answer to this, and it's kind of a curious thing, but perhaps Roger does. Have any figures been come forth that show what humans exhaling contribute to global warming? In other words, how many tons of CO2 just by us exhaling may contribute to global warming?
Well, don't everybody hold your breath all at once here. But yeah. No, I mean, I'm sure there's some kind of estimated metric on that. And I guess the only thing I can see is as the population would increase, or maybe as mammalian populations increase, if they are increasing, I don't know, that would contribute to a slight minutia amount. But it's really burning, you know, fossil fuels, taking it out of the ground and burning it for heat or transportation is what the problem is, or electricity. And of course, we have to change our ways, and we are slowly, but there is an interested, of course, segment in, it gets into the political realm where there's those who don't want to see that, and they feel threatened by that, so they put out, there's a massive industry of disinformation, and unfortunately, it's kind of connected at the hip, I guess, by the worldview of one political ideology.
Thanks for the call, Ernest. Let's go to Jim and Barry. Good morning, Jim.
Hi, good morning. I really appreciate you taking the time to look up stuff to find out whether it's true or not. The fact-check stuff is critically important.
Mm-hmm.
I've been caught so many times myself in recent times that I really appreciate that. But I have a question regarding something I brought up a couple of years ago, actually, and you didn't say you disputed it, but you didn't research it after I gave you the place to go look and everything. I'm kind of wondering why. It was... Vermont Statute 16 VSA 12 says that every principal, teacher, and educator in the state of Vermont shall, upon discharge of his or her duty, shall subscribe an oath or affirmation to support the Constitution of the United States of America, the Constitution of the state of Vermont, and the laws of the United States and the state of Vermont. You've never responded to that, and I've actually contacted two or three times about it, and why don't you research that and come back and say, yeah, that is in fact true. And my question is, when do they do it?
When do educators take the, it sounds like an oath of, similar to an oath of office to
military,
to uphold the Constitution? Or I guess the military personnel take a similar oath, right?
Joining upon.
I don't know. This is in Vermont Education Statute 16 VSA subsection 12.
Mm-hmm.
Titled Oath, and it says, you know, every teacher and principal and anyone that goes to a public school, teaches in a public school, blah, 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 but then it goes on, say, upon, except the state of Vermont of education, let me see, but upon taking the position, they have to subscribe to an oath. Upon entering the discharge of his or her duty, shall subscribe to an oath or affirmation to support the Constitution of the United States. I brought that up at a school board meeting 15 years ago, and the superintendent's reaction to it was they would never do that. The union would never allow that. It's like, I don't care. That's what the law says. I was asking when they do it, and I've been asking that question for 15 years. When do they do it? I just looked this up 5 minutes ago. It's still in the statute, according to Justia, the website, the law.justia.com. But anyway, I'll let you do some research on it, but I'd like you to respond back to it sometime.
16 VSA, what's the section?
Subsection 12, oath, just entitled oath. It says, a superintendent, principal, teacher in a public school of the state, or professor, instructor, or teacher who will be employed hereafter by a university or college in the state, which is supported in whole or in part by public funds, or an independent school or other educational institute accepted by the state Department of Education as furnishing equivalent education before entering yep. upon the discharge of their duties, shall subscribe to an oath.
Okay, I'm certainly, you know, subject to check, but I mean, I believe you that it is there in the statute. What do you think? I mean, what's the upshot here? What do you think that we're the school systems are falling down in their duty to have teachers and principals, et cetera, take this oath, or what's the issue?
It's a very black and white question with obviously some overtones to it, but I'm just asking, when in fact do they take it? Is it when they sign their license? Is a written affirmation, or when do they in fact?
Okay, that may be the case. I guess that would be a question for maybe the state agency of education, where but I will try to remember to check it out this time. Thanks for the reminder, Jim.
I will say this though, that I think an educator that has to take that oath mm-hmm. has a duty and an obligation to defend the Constitution, and I don't think that's actually happening. In fact, I would say the opposite is true. If someone's even discussing, they think that they should get rid of the Electoral College. Well, you know, that's in the Constitution. That's not defending the Constitution in that position. No one says that an individual citizen has to take that position, but an educator who takes public money, that's part of our state law.
So if you're a teacher and you are thinking that one of the provisions in the Constitution allows for the Constitution to be amended, correct?
It does, in fact, have that part of it. Absolutely.
Okay, so if you were a teacher who was saying, students, you might want to think about an amendment to the Constitution that would abolish the Electoral College, would that be permissible?
It would depend on whether they took a position. I think it's a completely germane discussion to, if you didn't like this, how would you go about changing it? But to actually take a position, or if they were playing devil's advocate and they were defending why they should have it, that's a great debate issue. There's a whole bunch of issues.
Yeah, sure. Yep.
I would say consistently some teachers, not all, of course, sometimes are outright advocates of things that they don't agree with in the Constitution.
Yeah,
and,
yep.
Or changing it. And that's, you know, the tree situation over in Spalding 10 years ago, where he had a picture of duct tape across Bush's mouth and a picture on the wall, and it ended up on national television. You know, that was really, and he ultimately got fired for something totally unrelated, but it took a long time. But that was just not acceptable in my book. Arguing talking about the junior ROTC kid as being future baby killers and stuff. But that's off the subject,
Yeah, Jim, I got to go, but I appreciate the call, and I will try to remember to check out the statute you mentioned and see if I'm not sure what to make of it, really. But if it's there, it's there. But thank you for the call. Let's go to Joe in Bristol. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Dave. Good morning, Roger. You know, it seems like that the debate over climate change and the climate change debate is pretty much turning into a religion. It's you can't question either side, and everybody's got their set beliefs, but there's very little proof. So we need some evidence. We need some evidence. I need a report that I
can
read.
Right.
That I can read. Listen. I have the names of some people that are looking for evidence.
There's evidence everywhere out there. This is not a debatable. Facts are not debatable. And
well, I don't see a written report that I can read and examine.
Oh, really? The international. Okay, the IPCC has put out I don't know how many reports now. You can go on any given number of sites. Go to climate. NASA.gov, I believe it is, or NOAA.gov. You can look at climatology. You can see for yourself what's going on, what the projections are, what's causing it, how it's being caused. There's a lot of stuff within those parameters we don't have an absolute clue on, but we have a pretty good idea, and all you have to do is look at all the glaciers and the Arctic sea ice melt and all of the poles. So there you go.
Yeah, but we have had that. For millions of years,
actually, the sun is actually getting cooler right now, and we should be cooling, and we're not. We're warming, and all you got to do is look at melting ice. When temperatures warm, ice melts. Now, how are you going to physically go against that?
Well, natural fluctuations in local climate and even world climate is common, right?
Right. That's associated with ocean. Like El Nino or La Nina or regional cooling, the medieval, ice age or whatever that was not a global ice age, et cetera, et cetera. There's natural phenomenon that will continually change the planet. The difference now is that it's the speed at which we're warming is the thing that's very different. And in past paleoclimatology, which they have a pretty good handle on using ice cores and sediments and bottoms of lakes and all sorts of things. They can recreate the paleoclimatology, and we've never warmed this fast in history, right now.
Okay, Joe, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. The impeachment inquiry rolls on in Washington. This weekend's big news seems to be that there was a announcement, a story anyway, that there is a second whistleblower who says he or she has firsthand knowledge of the phone call between the president and the president of Ukraine, that July 25th phone call that kind of got the ball rolling. All of this just a couple of weeks ago, remember, in the impeachment debate in Washington right now. And we wanted to get updated and perhaps shed some light on how Vermonters might want to be thinking about this. So I decided to bring in a couple people who've been following us quite closely and who have expressed an interest in this. Kevin Ellis is a blogger. He's first off a longtime journalist and then Montpelier lobbyist later in his career. And these days he's got a blog going, and he came out with a interesting blog post over the weekend. He's a critic of President Trump, I guess we could say, and someone who thinks that there may be some long-term historical trends that are being reflected in the current happenings here. Guy Page is a friend of the Dave Graham Show, is a not infrequent guest here, and is actually a defender of President Trump, likes what the president has been up to, and thinks that we can find out what Guy actually thinks about him, this impeachment stuff, from the man himself, because he's on the line with us this morning. And Kevin Ellis and Guy Page, thanks so much for joining me today.
Good to be here.
Glad to be here.
Hey, Guy.
Hey, Kevin. Kevin, weren't you also Governor Cunin's press secretary or something?
No. My former business partner, Bob Sherman, would object to that. That was his job.
Yeah. Kevin was in a lobbying firm called Kimball, Sherman, and Ellis. Kevin is the Ellis part of that, and Bob Sherman was the Sherman part of that. And Steve Kimball, I think, is over there, retired, in Tunbridge, is he, I think? Yeah. And hey, Steve, shout out to you if you're out there. A good guy, Steve Kimball. He was around Montpelier for a long time and a thoughtful fella, and always good talking with him. Anyway, I wanted to get the two of you guys to weigh in a little bit here. Guy Page, first of all, are you troubled at all, shaken, moved, stirred, or anything by this news this weekend that, the line from a lot of Republicans 10 days ago was that the whistleblower's report was all secondhand stuff. Now they supposedly have a firsthand whistleblower. Does that make any difference?
Well,
I'm about as troubled about that as I am about when Kavanaugh had a second, third, and fourth alleged victim of his sex crimes. I think it's just, you know, until they come up with something. I will say this, Dave. If there's some, you know, irrefutable proof, and he comes up with something that's really bad news, but until then, I just say it's more of the same, which is some stuff thrown out there, and, you know, who knows really what to make of it.
And Kevin Ellis, your blog post seemed to make the point that Trump is different from Nixon and is going to be putting up a much tougher fight.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the big difference between Nixon and Trump is that Trump cares nothing about government institutions, civic society at any level. He cares only about himself and his profits. And so, therefore, you know, Nixon actually had shame. And when the Republicans came to him and said, look, the jig is up, you know, he resigned. And I don't think Trump will do that, because for Trump to resign would be to admit some sort of defeat. And he learned never to do that from his mentor, the great Roy Cohn, who was Joe McCarthy's lawyer and advisor.
I can hear Guy taking a breath here and wanting to respond. We may have to save some of this, Guy, however, for the other side of the break here on the Dave Graham Show, because we actually got a little bit of a late start on this segment and need to go to a bottom of the hour CBS News report and a couple words from sponsors. But we can continue this conversation. I'm sure it'll be a good one after the break. Hey, folks, don't forget our podcast. Go to WDEVradio.com. Scroll down a bit, rather follow the link to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit, and you'll find recent shows here. Thanks to the Warren Store for the podcast sponsorship. We'll be back in just a couple.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
We are back and continuing our conversation with Guy Page, who's on the phone, I assume, from your home in Berlin. Is that right, Guy?
Yes. I apologize, Dave. I was on Bill Sayre time, the 11 o'clock time.
Ah, okay.
Like, oh, no. Well, I'm sorry.
That's okay. That is all right. Telephones work, too. And Kevin Ellis is actually live in the studio here. But we'll try to give you, the two of you, roughly equal time if we can. And Guy, I think you were about to respond to something that Kevin had been saying before the break, which had to do with Kevin's perception that the president of the United States doesn't really give much of a darn about civil government and the institutions of government, and is more interested in his own power and his own profits.
Yeah, the profits. This is the first president in the history of the republic to donate his entire salary to nonprofits. So I'm not terribly sure he's really in this for the money, guys. As far as the whole thing about Nixon, no, this is really very different from Dick Nixon, and I think all three of us were kind of around at that time. With Nixon, a crime had actually been committed and verified before the impeachment talk began. But, you know, where's the confirmed crime here with Trump? There really isn't one. So that really the House is putting the cart before the horse. And if Speaker Pelosi is really concerned about, you know, the integrity of government, the strength of the institutions, et cetera, she just ought to hold a formal vote on impeachment. You know, that's what the institution requires, but we're not hearing that.
Kevin Ellis, is there a confirmed crime committed by this president?
Impeachment is not a criminal process. It's a political process. So you got to go back, everybody, and read the Constitution. The problem with
high crimes and misdemeanors.
That's right. Alexander Hamilton and James Madison. But it's not the same as violation of a criminal statute. It's a different process. And everybody, this is what I wrote about last week, Dave, is we're for some reason, most of us no longer read the reading. And we forget what these processes are set up for. No one's saying that, at least I'm not, that Trump's committed a crime and we're convicting him ahead of time. The House is doing an investigation. So they're going to gather evidence, as is their job under the Constitution, and they're going to submit that evidence to the full House and see if there's a vote. The vote shouldn't take place now. First, they have to have a committee hearings and investigations. And you're seeing that with all these text messages from Trump's various ambassadors and other appointees who are having secret text messages. And then at the last minute, they're saying, oh, we better get off text message and do this on the phone so none of this stuff becomes public.
The guy, I wonder your view of this this new revelation this weekend about a second whistleblower who allegedly has a firsthand account of the phone call of July 25th. You say you're not at all troubled by this. It's just more of the same.
Until it isn't, Dave. It's more of the same. And the first whistleblower was coached by Adam Schiff for a month and was a Democratic donor. You know, not a whole lot of credibility there. So yeah, sure. Hey, if he comes up with some sort of smoking gun, as they used to say back in the Watergate era, well, that would be one thing. But, you know, they've been talking since before this man actually took oath. They've been talking about impeaching him and all the crimes he's committed and all the terrible things he's done. All he's really done is, you know, reduce taxes, renegotiate some bad trade deals, keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of Iran. Oh, yeah, 6.4 million new jobs, including among minorities, best employment rate ever among minorities. So what he's actually done, actually been pretty good. Not just for, you know, his cronies or whatever, but really for everyone. And it baffles me that there are some people who seem to be obsessed with we've got to get rid of this man who is making our economy better, you know, is dealing with China the way it needs to be dealt with, is getting good trade deals all over the world. Where's the beef?
Let me ask Kevin Ellis. Kevin Ellis, where's the beef?
You know, I can't think of one trade deal or I can't think of one thing that Trump's done that what Guy says is actually true. Those are Trump talking points, Republican talking points, but this is a big battleship of an economy. This is Obama's economy. How long are we gonna do this charade? We have no deal with North Korea, no deal with China.
We got a deal with Japan. We got an international postal agreement that was the China was hosing the whole country, the whole world.
Right.
And you know, they worked that. That was announced. Jim Condos was the only person who actually flagged this because it had to do with sending ballots overseas. But this is something that 2 weeks ago, the Trump administration forced China through the UN to renegotiate its postal standards and what it was charging for like airmail and that kind of thing. And it's, you know, you may see it as small, but it's a significant step forward in getting China to deal fairly with the rest of the world, which is something the rest of the world had just, our leadership had punted on.
Right.
They'd given up.
Hear, hear. Good. But compared to the racism and the inciting of violence and calling reporters treasonous, it pales to that, in my view.
He called the Speaker of the House treasonous this weekend.
He called the Speaker of the House a traitor.
So,
well, what have they been calling him, guys? Come on, ever since. They've been calling him the worst thing, and he's been hung in effigy, and traitor, 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 traitor.
Has the Speaker of the House called him a traitor? Has she used that word, Kevin?
No.
Many have. you know, I don't...
So... I mean, this is one thing that does disturb me from time to time, is that some people don't seem to understand that the president's words carry a lot more weight than even a first-term member of Congress. I mean, the other day I was faulting the president for some of the language he's been using in his public pronouncements lately, and just kind of leading us toward an increasingly coarse discourse in our country. Mm-hmm. And somebody called me up and said, well, Kamala Harris called him a mother bleep. And I said, first off, that's wrong. It wasn't Kamala Harris. It was Rashida Tlaib. And secondly, whose voice carries more weight? The president of the United States or a first-term member of Congress whose name a lot of Americans can't pronounce? And I guess apparently that's declared even by some. I have a hard time with that myself. What do you think, Guy?
You and I would actually have some agreement kind of on that, Dave, in that mm-hmm. he definitely uses a lot of coarse language.
Yep.
And I think a lot of the people who support what he is doing, which they consider more important than some words he uses, they sort of wish that he would be a little more diplomatic in some of the language that he chooses.
Okay.
But the point is, what has the man done? And for that matter, what did it get George W. Bush to be all sweetness, light, and diplomacy? Not a whole lot. He was still hated. You know, still beaten up right and left. So Trump is just a different animal. He's saying, look, I have a zeal to drain the swamp, and sometimes nice guys don't drain the swamp.
Has he drained the swamp, Guy?
Well, with Biden, he's sure trying to, isn't he?
Oh, come on.
What you had there was a VP. No. Hey, sorry.
Okay.
Can you imagine if Jordan Kushner, or whatever his name is, his son-in-law, was on the board of Russia's biggest energy company, and Trump was trying to get a deal done? Are you kidding me? You guys would be screaming about that.
Well, actually, I have screamed.
No, it's all okay.
No. Let's be clear here. I have screamed very loud online saying that the Hunter Biden, that is an outrage. But that doesn't.
Okay.
But that's fine. And I it is a total outrage. But that doesn't excuse what we're seeing right in front of us, which is a president of the United States strong-arming another foreign leader to gather political damaging intelligence against a political rival. That is clearly an impeachable offense.
You're focusing on the rival part. I'm saying that he's setting a higher standard of behavior for presidents, not only our presidents, but for world leaders, if you just don't put up with this crap.
But we put up with Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn and all of the people who were indicted under Trump. How is that draining the swamp?
Are Jared Kushner's ties to Saudi Arabia going to help us drain the swamp in Riyadh?
You know, I'm actually not terribly up on all of those details, I got to say.
Well, the reason I raise that actually is because Connor Friedersdorf in The Atlantic this past week had a really interesting piece where he sort of speculated, he imagined the future in which we have a President Kamala Harris. I know that's going to not make you happy, Guy, to think about, but so President Kamala Harris calls up a foreign leader and starts asking questions about whether they should investigate Ivanka Trump, Don Jr., Eric Trump and Jared Kushner for all of their foreign dealings while their father was in the White House. And how are you going to react to that when that happens?
I would say, first of all, I don't really know what they've done. I'm obviously, if someone calls for something, they're going to call for something. It's what they do. It's politics. But as far as actual misdeeds, I guess I'm just not as educated as you guys are.
So President Harris holds up U.S. military aid to some foreign country and says, by the way, we would like you to investigate the foreign dealings during 2019 by Jared Kushner.
I guess it would be pretty similar to Senate Appropriations Vice Chair Patrick Leahy making the same sort of request to the government of Ukraine.
And
it's the same thing. What you have is the guy with his hands on the purse strings,
yeah,
saying, give us what we want, or all this wonderful progress you've been seeing in the last few years, kiss it goodbye.
Yeah, I know. You were making this point a couple of weeks ago, and of course, I mean, the thing that I think makes it a false equivalency is that if Leahy were calling the president of Ukraine and asking for an investigation of Scott Milne, I would say let's impeach Leahy. But
travel dealings in Ukraine.
Of course, you can't impeach a sitting senator, as the president wrongly pointed out the other day. It's, again, read the Constitution.
Hey, let's bring in a caller. We have Dave from Brookfield on the line. Good morning, Dave.
Hi, good morning. One thing I'm thinking of is he mentioned, I can't remember Mr. Ellis's name, but he mentioned
Kevin Ellis.
Yeah, hi. That he's disregarding all the institutions and, you know, basically what you said. And last I knew, I haven't looked for a year or so, the Congress's approval rate was about 12%. I don't know what it is now. So I don't quite follow that. If the approval rate is under 20%, how is he tearing down the legislature, who the public already feels is not doing a very good job? And, you know, I don't understand why he's being, you're accusing him of tearing everything down when a lot of the public feels basically the same way.
Let's let Kevin Ellis answer the question. What do you think, Kevin?
It's irrelevant. It's got nothing to do with the approval rate of the Congress or media or anything else. The question is, did he commit a high crime or misdemeanor as spelled out in the Constitution? It's got nothing to do with the approval rate of Congress.
Yeah, but you said he's trying to tear down. He ignores all the government institutions.
Yep.
And also, I may be wrong on this, but my understanding was that this investigation that we've been conducting about this phone call started before Biden even announced to run for president.
It's true.
The let me ask you this, sir, Dave from Brookfield. The president of the United States has repeatedly called the whistleblower a traitor and someone who should be arrested, et cetera. Now, one of the institutions of our government is the whistleblower laws, which allow people to report wrongdoing inside the government and have a certain amount of protection from any retribution or whatever.
I'm not disagreeing with that.
Okay, is the president attempting to tear down this institution of the whistleblower law and the whistleblower tradition in this country, which, by the way, dates all the way back to the 18th century? The first whistleblowers were active during the American Revolution, reporting to the Continental Congress.
What is he doing? Is he throttling the whistleblower?
He's demanding the whistleblower's name be made public. He's actually calling him a traitor. I mean, treason is punishable by death.
What does that matter? What he calls somebody?
Well,
like you were discussing what people have been calling Trump.
If the head of the executive branch of government is calling an individual within the government a traitor, that's a crime punishable by death. And if you are the head of the executive branch of government, you're effectively calling for somebody's death, right?
I would not say so.
You wouldn't? Okay.
And what Biden did, you've seen the clip, I'm sure, what he said about what he did to pressure the people over there to fire the investigator. Is that okay? You've seen that clip, right?
No, I don't I don't think that is okay.
And he was laughing about it.
Yeah, I don't think that's okay.
The investigation goes back to 2015 or 16. And what Trump and Rudy Giuliani for him have been looking into this started well before Biden even announced to run for president. And now it's being said that he's digging up dirt on Biden, who wasn't even running for president when the investigation was looked into by Giuliani.
So, Dave, you're missing one key point here. You're right. It started way before Biden declared for president. But it wasn't just asking Ukraine to dig up dirt on Biden. It was asking Ukraine to start an investigation of the Hillary Clinton campaign and the 2016
exactly.
campaign.
Exactly.
When are you guys going to give up on Hillary Clinton? My heavens.
Hey, we got to take another call. Thanks for the call, Dave. Appreciate it. Let's go to Marcia and Barry.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
I hope I can join the playground.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, girls are allowed.
All right.
In fact, folks, I've said this repeatedly on the Dave Graham Show. I want more women callers out there.
Good.
I really do.
I'm a woman and
I appreciate
proud
it.
Of it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
I just want to point out that the impeachment inquiry is trying very hard to avoid misconduct of the president, which would offend society, which is basically what the range of wrong act which is the range of wrongdoing which was historically allowed in impeachment, and going for actual crimes, because they understand that this is what the people now will understand. The actual crime that they're trying to hone in now is an election statute and an election law, which says that it is a crime to solicit foreigners for help in a campaign. It doesn't say anything about trading or quid pro quo. It's just soliciting, which is actually a very, very mild way of asking for help in a campaign. I agree with a lot of the policies of the Federal Election Commission, such as how they run their the debates and the topics and who is allowed to come in. But this is a law. Okay, now there are a lot of scofflaws out in the world who want to weigh one law against another and say, oh, that law doesn't really matter. It really didn't amount to something really heavy, you know. But the fact is, this is what it is. And I don't like what Biden did either with his son. I think now, unfortunately, he is, and I am not agreeing with the propaganda that said what Biden and his son did. Absolutely not. But I think he's tainted insofar as he supported the oil and gas industry there, mm-hmm. and the fact that Hunter went and got involved with it. Now he's smeared, and I think he's tainted, and I don't want to vote for him. I'm absolutely for Bernie. But the fact is, you guys have to stop the and look at the facts. The facts are, this is a law that was violated, and that's all.
So, just putting this in essence, if I can, Marcia, tell me if I'm getting you right here.
Yeah.
The law you're referring to says that a U.S. person shall not take from or seek from a foreign person anything of value in connection with promoting an election in the United States.
Yes.
And the value here would be the information negative about the Bidens.
Yes, that's how it's been interpreted.
Okay. It's an important point, because Guy was
Weintraub, who is the head of the FEC.
Yeah, and it's an important point, and thanks for the reminder, because Guy was earlier saying that, unlike Nixon, where you had the Watergate break-in, there was no discernible crime here, and you're saying it sounds like there actually is a discernible crime.
Well, the reason why they're focusing on a discernible crime is because nowadays, and since the Clinton impeachment, the broad range of allowable misconduct, which made up a quote high crime and misdemeanor unquote is hard for a lot of folks to understand.
Yeah. But okay, let me go to Guy Page here and ask you, Guy, does that bring the thing back into focus when Marcia makes the point that we do have a discernible crime if what seemed to be happening on that phone call was in fact happening, where there was somebody in the United States is trying to promote an outcome in an election by soliciting information negative about a political opponent from a foreign person?
I don't know an awful lot about federal law. I don't think that is what was happening on that phone call. I think it was trying to set a standard of good behavior for senior leaders in the United States and worldwide. However, if it in fact is a violation of federal law, then absolutely they ought to go ahead and bring that charge in the House.
Okay.
That's their job. If they really, really think.
Yeah.
That something was brought, then I guess they ought to do that. But I'm just not sure it was. Like, I don't think it was. And I don't think the American people are going to be all that crazy about that either. They're going to see it for the politics that it is.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see as much of the politics stripped away as I could. I mean, I do think that at some point, if a crime's been committed and there's an enforcement mechanism set up, as in impeachment by the Congress, that the Congress then presumably would have a duty, just like the local sheriff. Somebody robs the bank, and the local sheriff has a duty to go out and try to apprehend the robber. That's kind of the system that is set up here in its purest form. Now, obviously, I will acknowledge that on all sides and then some, a little bit of politics has been layered on, perhaps. Kevin, sure. Kevin Ellis, what do you think about this question?
Well, Marcia raised a good point. I mean, I would point out the first crime named in one of the early indictments of the Mueller investigation, which was the payments to Stormy Daniels. That was explicitly laid out by the Mueller and the U.S. attorney as a crime. They didn't indict him because they left it to the Congress to do that investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Pelosi, unlike what Guy's saying, there's this rush to impeach the president. Pelosi's been resisting impeachment for months and years. So I think we're, you know, I think Marcia makes a very good point. And Guy and I will argue till the cows come home about the intent of that phone call with the president of Ukraine, but we obviously see it very differently.
All right. Well, I think, unfortunately, we're going to have to pretty much leave it there because we're fast approaching the top of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM. My guests have been Guy Page, conservative commentator here in Vermont, and Kevin Ellis, a blogger and, I guess, liberal commentator, one might say, here in Vermont. And I appreciate the two of you joining us and all the callers as well. Interesting conversation.
Thank you, Dave.
All righty. Hey, folks, stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio, and come back tomorrow morning for another edition of the Dave Graham Show. Have a great day, everybody.